You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During his confirmation hearings for Chief Justice, John Roberts said that judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. But in his new book, New Yorker staff writer and CNN's senior legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin demonstrates that the personalities on the court influence the decisions as much as the law and the rules. He's called his book The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, and in today's New York Times, Michiko Kakutani praised it for being as informative as it is fascinating, as insightful as it is readable. The book is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jeffrey Toobin back to the show.
Hi, Lenny.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Why were the most of the justices and their clerks willing to speak to you? Was talking to you a way for some of them to vent their frustrations about what's going on in the court?
I think that may have been part of it for some of them. And also, I think the institution is changing a little bit in a very slow Supreme Court stately way in that, you know, you have some younger people on the court who have grown up in an environment where the news media is not something to be feared and loathed and detested, at least all the time. And I think some justices are very concerned that the work of the court be understood beyond the circle of lawyers who actually read their opinions regularly. So some people talk. Some people don't.
The Brethren had a real impact on the Burger Court. Do you think this court will respond in the same way, or is it kind of impervious to that?
No. I mean, I think the Brethren did have a big impact, and I actually write a little bit about the Brethren. The Brethren was such a shot out of the blue. I mean, in 1979, when the Brethren was published, there had never been anything like that, whereas I am writing on 27 years after the Brethren. But if you recall the Brethren, the theme of that book was how much the justices just despised Warren Burger. I mean, it was very much about the internal tensions in the court. And the court pulled back after the Brethren. I think they were shocked at how ugly it seemed. And it took a long time to get access again. And there was not a similar kind of personal animosity in the court during the period I'm writing about.
Do you think that the justices will recognize themselves in the way that you've portrayed them in the book?
I hope so. I mean, one of the things that is fun about writing about justices or anyone else at book length is you can give rounded portraits of people, that they are not just one thing. You can say they're liberal and conservative, but they're all interesting, complicated people, and that was my goal in portraying them.
Although you say nine, actually there are more because you also cover some of the people who have left the court.
In fact, if anyone is a protagonist of the book, it's Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, who is not on the court anymore.
But let's talk about the former Chief Justice, William Rehnquist. You say he was more of an administrator in his later years on the court. Had he become less interested in fighting for his legal philosophy after all of those years?
I think he was old and tired. And this was an extraordinary period in the court's history, 1994 to 2005, 11 years when the membership of the court did not change. It was the longest time in the history of the nine-justice court that there was no change in membership. Rehnquist knew what everybody thought. He knew everybody's positions on issues. And he didn't have the energy of banging his head against the wall trying to get people to overturn Roe v. Wade when he knew it wasn't going to happen. He didn't change his views, but there was just not the same urgency and energy. And also, you know, he was 82 when he left.
And he'd gotten ill.
And he'd gotten ill. And even before it was ill, you know, people who are in their late 70s and don't have the same energy and determination often that people who are younger do. And he just wanted to see the court move smoothly rather than, you know, radically change direction.
But you portray Justice Scalia as being almost bored by his work on the court, even after the arrival of Justices Alito and Roberts.
You know, some people like the job better than others, and it's true of any job.
You could quit.
Well, you know, they also understand the alternatives. And, you know, I think if Justice Scalia had the option of being as listened to off the court, he would probably leave. But he's also a loyal conservative and is certainly not going to give his seat if he can to a Democratic president. And He also likes the attention and the power of being a justice, but he is not someone who loves the court the way some of them do.
Well, considering that 8 out of the 9 justices who were on the court in 1992 had been appointed by Republican presidents, should we be surprised that by the end of George H.W. Bush's term, the court hadn't overturned Roe v. Wade?
I think when you look at who's nominated the justices, it is surprising how moderate the court has been. I mean, as you point out, in 92, it was 8 out of 9 justices who were appointed by Republicans. Today, it's 11 of the last 13 have been appointed by Republicans. Now, it is true that only in recent years has ideological conformity become mandatory for Republican presidents. I mean, there are never going to be David Souters nominated in my lifetime anymore by Republican presidents, you know, that is moderate Republicans. But the political environment has changed so that the court is a much more polarized place.
We saw that when Harriet Myers was proposed by George Bush. I think we all can assume that she's a very conservative person and yet not conservative enough for conservatives.
I think the Myers story, which of course was fun to write about because it had aspects of black comedy. I mean, she was somewhat unfairly, but also somewhat fairly, a comic figure by the end of her brief 29-day nomination to the Supreme Court. But the important thing to remember about Myers is that she is probably the first person in history to withdraw from Supreme Court nomination when she likely would have been confirmed. And the reason she did was that the conservative right turned against her because she was not 100% guarantee that she would be a lockstep conservative. Now, I think, frankly, she probably would have been. But they wanted a sure thing, and they got one in Samuel Alito.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, and his latest book is The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, which is published by Doubleday. There's always been a lot of speculation about Clarence Thomas, especially since he rarely gives interviews and he doesn't say much during oral arguments. The press has portrayed him as simply going along with anything that Antonin Scalia decides. Is that a fair description?
Totally, totally unfair. I mean, that is just not an accurate reflection of how he works or what his views are. He is far more conservative than Antonin Scalia. He is more conservative than any justice who has served since the 1930s. I was at one of the wonderful things about Justice Scalia is that he is sometimes a little unbuttoned in his behavior, and he spoke at a synagogue in New York not too long ago, and someone asked him, "What's your judicial philosophy compared to Justice Thomas's?" And he spoke for a while. He said, "Look, I'm an originalist. I'm a textualist, but I'm not a nut." And I think that
he called Thomas a nut.
That was certainly the implication. And what he meant is that Thomas doesn't really believe in precedent the way the other justices do. He thinks that if it's wrong, it should just be overturned. And that doesn't just go for Roe v. Wade, of course, which he wants overturned. But that goes with the decisions, you know, that the Roosevelt Court made upholding the New Deal. I mean, he basically thinks the New Deal is unconstitutional.
But precedent really does seem to be not the highest point, the highest concern of this court. They're just not saying we are ignoring precedent. They are just doing it.
You know, I think precedent is something that the justices on both sides pay a lot more lip service to than they really engage in. You know, in the everyday cases, in the cases about federal statutes that don't make the newspaper, sure, they're happy to follow precedent. But when it comes to the hot-button political issues, they are guided more by their conscience and their ideology than by precedent. You know, the liberals were only too happy in 2003 in Lawrence v. Texas to overturn the Bowers v. Hardwick, which was the gay sodomy decision. You know, that was they threw out a fairly recent precedent of the court, and I think the conservatives now, now one of my complaints about the Roberts Court is that they're not being honest about what they're doing. In these last series of decisions, they have been gutting precedents, but not really saying they've been gutting precedents.
And only Scalia and Breyer seem to be expressing any concern.
Right.
About
I
that.
Mean, Scalia wrote some concurring opinions you know, he was only too happy with what the court was doing, but he was saying, come on, guys, let's be honest. These old opinions are toast. And I think Roberts is trying to pretend that the court is following precedent when it's really not.
So we have this this odd situation, which I think may set another kind of precedent in the future, and that is that even recent decisions don't mean very much. For example, if the court were to go in the other direction, liberals could just simply throw out everything that this court has decided.
And that's one of the risks the court runs when it doesn't follow precedent, is that if it becomes such an unstable institution, one of the things that people revere about the Supreme Court is that it's very slow moving, and that, you know, it doesn't lurch in one direction after another. And you know, that may simply not be the case. I don't know.
Thomas has been unable to build coalitions even on some of the less controversial rulings because they see him as a nut, or because he's alienated people.
I don't think it's personal. In fact, one of the paradoxes of Thomas is that as ideologically isolated as he is personally very much liked by his colleagues, but his views are so extreme that he alienates the Anthony Kennedys, the Sandra Day O'Connors, the David Souters, who control the outcome of many cases, and he has a hard time assembling majorities, which was one reason why William Rehnquist, who did the opinion assigning, which is one of the duties of the Chief Justice, rarely gave Thomas important opinions to do.
Is there camaraderie? Do these people like each other, or do the conservatives tend to hang out with each other and the liberals tend to hang out with each other?
It's very interesting. I mean, that was a subject that I really was interested in myself. Like, what's it like? How do they deal?
And do they go out drinking afterwards?
Well, it's a very specific kind of camaraderie. They are very polite to each other. They are very respectful of one another. They don't badmouth each other in person or to other people. This is a very cordial court. There are almost no real friendships. They spend very little time together outside of the bench. In both respects, that's unusual in Supreme Court history. There have been horrible fights in the past. Felix Frankfurter and William Douglas despised each other openly. William Brennan and Earl Warren loved each other, were some of the closest friends. This court is different. It's cordial, but there are very few real friendships. The only real friendship over the last decade was Stephen Breyer and Sandra Day O'Connor. I mean, they had very similar sort of practical temperaments. They traveled the world together, but not beyond that, not much.
And you say that although Sandra Day O'Connor is generally described as the swing vote on that court, Breyer was just as much a swing vote.
Well, he built this alliance with O'Connor in the period of 2001 to 2005. And, you know, That really leads into one of my favorite subjects, which is Bush v. Gore.
And we'll get to that
okay,
after
but,
the break.
Okay, but I mean, I'm sorry, you want to take a break now?
No, we're going to we're going to take a little break, and because I want to devote a fair amount of time
okay,
to that.
But I mean, O'Connor changed after Bush v. Gore. She moved to the left, and she moved in a moderate position that was very similar to Breyer's jurisprudence. And there were some cases, O'Connor moved so far that she was more to the left. In the Ten Commandments cases, she was more strict on the separation of church and state than Breyer was.
Well, Breyer was a kind of a conservative Democrat, and many liberals were upset when Bill Clinton appointed him.
Yeah, they should only be so lucky to have more like him now. He's no raging liberal, but he's far from a conservative.
Jeffrey Toobin is my guest, the author of bestsellers like Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, The Run of His Life. The latest is The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, published by Doubleday. Stay with us. We're back with Jeffrey Toobin, whose latest book is The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, published by Doubleday. And as we were going to the break, you were kind of suggesting that the court's decision in Bush v. Gore changed its dynamic. Why did the justices even agree to hear the case? They must have known it was going to cause a lot of trouble.
You know, one of the things the Supreme Court does is it works according to a certain rhythm. And it's fairly slow. You know, each case takes months to resolve itself. The Florida case came at them so fast and so unexpectedly that they didn't really have time to think. And I think it reflected badly in their work product. And a lot of it turned on O'Connor, because O'Connor reacts to things at kind of a gut level often. And she didn't like what she heard out of Florida. She thought people were whining about votes, that they had screwed up themselves. She comes from a ranch. She believes in self-sufficiency. And she thought that the election should have been over. And she was also sympathetic to Bush.
And as a lifelong Republican.
As a lifelong Republican and a friend of not George W. Bush, but as a friend of his parents. And she just wanted to get the case out over with. And she thought that the Florida Supreme Court was a bunch of Democratic hacks who were trying to get Gore elected. So the court grabbed onto this case, even though it only dealt with Florida law and only dealt with election procedures that the court had never dealt with previously. And Scalia, in particular, was also convinced that the Florida Supreme Court was out to steal the election for Gore. And they just grabbed at it. And I think the result was quite unbecoming.
Do you think that Sandra Day O'Connor regrets her vote?
Sandra Day O'Connor is not one for regrets. She is not someone who has ever said, in my knowledge, to me or anyone else, I regret my vote. In any case, she's not someone who looks back. The one thing she is not happy about was the Bush presidency and how it turned out.
But many people were unhappy with the argument that Justice Kennedy used to support the court's decision. You could have come up with a better argument and maybe have set a more interesting precedent here.
See, what bothers so many people about Bush v. Gore and what makes it look so partisan is that this is a court that interpreted the Equal Protection Clause very narrowly when it came to blacks and women. But George W. Bush gets the benefit of an Equal Protection Clause claim that had never been adopted before by the court in an opinion where they explicitly say, you know, this ticket is good for this train only, where they write, you know, this case can't be cited in the future, which really is not what appeals courts are supposed to do.
Is Kennedy a bad writer? Because many people were upset with the way he worded the recent decision on late-term abortion.
Well, I don't think he's a bad writer. I think he has a pompous streak, and he sometimes speaks with a grandiloquence that is not justified under the circumstances. And he has a very highfalutin idea of how judges should behave, and he wants to be perceived as fair and a lawgiver. And in the partial birth abortion case, you know, he wrote, well, you see, this decision is really good for women because many women come to regret abortions. Now, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and many others were outraged at the paternalism of that attitude, but it's in keeping with Kennedy's sense of himself as a fair lawgiver, which sometimes I think leads him into some purple prose.
Well, today he is considered the new swing vote, but he's not a swing vote in the way that Sandra Day O'Connor was a swing vote.
No, but I think he is a swing vote. I mean, he is not as liberal as O'Connor. He is clearly a more conservative justice, but there are certain issues that he is definitely more liberal or less conservative than Scalia, Roberts, Alito, and Thomas. On the Guantanamo Bay cases, he has been against the Bush administration. On gay rights, he has been with the liberals. On death penalty cases in recent years, he's been more liberal. So, but on race, on abortion, he's definitely on the right now.
And he's also upset conservative Republicans for citing international law in a decision he wrote that banned the execution of minors.
I mean, this to me was one of, I mean, again, this is why I like studying the justices. I mean, how could you find a more provincial man on the surface than Anthony Kennedy? When he was nominated to the Supreme Court at the age of 50, he still lived in the house in Sacramento where he grew up. Yet, he is a person with this tremendous international wanderlust. He teaches every summer in Salzburg. I went with him one summer and wrote a piece about him for The New Yorker there. He loves international law. He spends tremendous time training judges and talking to judges from around the world. And that influenced him. And that is in part why on issues like the Geneva Convention, which matters so much abroad, and gay rights, which is widely supported in Europe, he has moved to the left, and that infuriates conservatives.
And yet it seems that it's a lot easier to predict how the court's going to vote these days than it was under Rehnquist.
Absolutely. In part,
even
that's because...
Even with Kennedy, because he's more likely to vote with the conservative majority.
Right, but O'Connor was a tremendous wild card.
Because she was really, practical? Is that why?
Well, because she was practical is one way of putting it. I think political is another way of putting it. She had this tremendous instinct for where the American public was on any given issue. She was for abortion rights, but with restrictions like parental consent laws. She was for some use of affirmative action, but not quotas. She was for the death penalty, but limiting its use. And, you know, she didn't have an overarching judicial philosophy, which infuriates some law professors, and it certainly infuriated Justice Scalia. But she tailored her views. I'm not saying in an unethical way. She was very unpredictable, or not very, or somewhat unpredictable, in a way that the nine justices on the court now are not unpredictable.
And you said that she was dismayed by the direction of the GOP after President Bush took office. Are any of the other older Republicans in the court unhappy with what's happened politically?
Well, I think John Paul Stevens and David Souter are clearly lost causes to conservatives at this point.
Both well, Stevens, you say, wrote the best argument in Gore v.
In
Bush, or
absolutely.
Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, I mean, John Paul Stevens is even to his colleagues, a rather mysterious figure. He's a loner. He's now by far the senior justice on the court, been on the court since 1975. Often famous in his early years for writing solitary opinions, concurrences, or dissents. But, you know, he is a brilliant man who has really thought through all of his views on constitutional law, and even if they're not shared all the time by his colleagues, he marches to his own drummer. And I thought on Bush v. Gore, he was a remarkable presence.
Are the older justices like John Paul Stevens and Ruth Bader Ginsburg waiting for a new administration before they decide whether they want to retire or not?
I think the straight answer to that is yes. John Stevens is 87 years old. He's in remarkable health. One of my favorite facts about Justice Stevens is that his older brother, Bill Stevens, is still practicing law in Florida at age 90. So, you know, he's not in any imminent health danger, but he is, you know, 87 is 87. I think Justice Ginsburg is an older 76. Justice Souter is 69, but not happy on the court, not somewhat. I think all three of them are likely to leave in the next few years, which makes the 2008 election tremendously important for the court.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, whose latest book is The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You reveal that David Souter almost resigned after the Bush v. Gore decision. What made him stay?
Well, you know, I have to confess perhaps that Souter is my favorite justice just because he is such an unusual person. You know, he lives this 19th century lifestyle. As many people know, he's a bachelor. He doesn't use a TV. He doesn't use a computer. He doesn't have a fax machine. When he arrived at the court, he'd never heard of Diet Coke. He was at a wedding in 2003 where someone mentioned the singing group The Supremes, and he'd never heard of The Supremes. Yet, only Stevens probably on the court is smarter than Souter and more dedicated. And Souter has an old-fashioned idea of the court as divorced from politics. And he was distraught about Bush v. Gore, and he just didn't think he could serve with these people at one point. But time heals a lot of wounds. He's also a frugal New Englander, and he was only eligible to retire at full salary in 2004. So he decided, well, you know, let me think this over for a while, and in time he recovered his equilibrium.
He'll wait until he gets the full pension.
Right, which is ironic for many reasons, considering he leads this practically ascetic lifestyle, and he made some savvy investments in the 1980s, and he's got $10 million in the bank.
Now, a lot of people have described him as a surprise because he was appointed by a Republican president. Was he really a surprise? Should they have been surprised?
You know, one of the things myths I try to take on in the nine is this idea that Supreme Court justices turn out to be big surprises. There really haven't been many surprises in the recent history of the court. If you looked at David Souter's record on the New Hampshire Supreme Court, he was a moderate. If you listen to his testimony in the Senate Judiciary Committee, this was an old-fashioned moderate Republican. There is nothing terribly surprising about how he turns out. And if you look at all the subsequent justices, Thomas, Breyer, Ginsburg, Alito, Roberts, they all are precisely as advertised.
But often judges change. Justices have changed in the past. We saw that with Blackmun, for example.
Well, but Blackmun, you're going back to the 70s. Yes, Blackmun did change. Yes, O'Connor changed a little. But that's the rule is they don't change. And I think it's funny. I hear a lot of liberals sometimes say, oh, you know, I think Roberts is going to change. He's so smart. Liberals think intelligence equals being a liberal, by the way. That's something I've noticed. And you know what? He's both intelligent and a conservative, and he's going to stay precisely that way decade after decade on the court.
The court almost seemed to swing to the left as a kind of course correction after the Bush v. Gore decision. But that changed when Roberts was and Alito were appointed?
Overnight. I mean, you know, mostly it changed because of Alito and O'Connor. But, you know, if you look at the period of 2001 to 2005, it was almost a sort of Prague Spring of liberalism on the court. If you look, you know, decisions about striking down the death penalty for juveniles and for mentally retarded and the gay sodomy decision and all the repudiations of the Bush administration on Guantanamo Bay, that was because O'Connor and Kennedy had moved to the left.
In fact, until O'Connor stepped down, the court seemed determined to check the Bush administration's assertion of executive powers in wartime. And then things changed.
Well, we don't know, because they haven't really had a big Guantanamo case since O'Connor has left the court.
Scalia did write an interesting dissent in one of the decisions.
Scalia has quirky views on a very few subjects, and he and Stevens, an odd couple, rejected the Bush administration together. But if you look at the backgrounds of Roberts and Alito, they both come out of the executive branch in the Reagan administration, where one of the touchstones was a belief in expanded executive power. So I can't imagine that they will be like O'Connor was. And again, particularly on the Guantanamo cases, Anthony Kennedy's going to hold all the cards.
So let's get back to the confirmation hearings when John Roberts said judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. Are judges umpires, and has Roberts behaved like an umpire in his short time in the court?
I think John Roberts may emerge as one of the smartest people and one of the best writers ever, you know, to be on the court in recent years. I mean, we are talking about an absolutely brilliant man. And I think that statement that the justices are like umpires is close to disingenuous. They make the rules. I mean, just last year, school boards of Louisville and Seattle had decided that, you know what, we want to preserve racial balance in our schools. We want, you know, to consider race in how we assign kids. That's how the democratic process works. The Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, we're going to make the rules here, not you in the democratic process. And that's what the court does all the time, sometimes from the left and sometimes from the right. But the idea that all they're doing is sort of mechanistically applying the law, I mean, you got to be kidding.
Well, even umpires sometimes call an inside pitch a strike when it should be a ball.
But the justices are a lot more like the commissioner of baseball than a baseball umpire.
So the ones who are most likely to retire are mostly on the liberal side. The conservatives are all fairly young, aren't they?
Scalia and Kennedy are getting up there. They're now just turning 70. So they are. But as for Supreme Court justice, that's not terribly old. But certainly, the three most likely to leave are Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg, and those are three of the four liberals.
So it doesn't matter who becomes the next president in that regard. The court will still remain a conservative majority. It just will be a matter of how many conservatives
will be on the court. Right. I mean, there's a big difference between, you know, a 4.5 justice majority and a 7.5 justice majority. I mean, those three justices are replaced by conservatives, it will be something like the Warren Court in reverse, where in the mid-60s, the Supreme Court had seven liberals on it. And that, you know, had predictable implications.
You think Roe v. Wade will be overturned?
Dead certain. Dead lock certain that Roe v. Wade will be overturned if if those liberals are replaced by a Republican president.
But not until then? Won't Kennedy still
No, Kennedy signed on to the Casey opinion in 1992 and I think still believes that an outright ban on abortion, you know, at every stage of pregnancy would be unconstitutional. But I think that's just about the only abortion law he would find unconstitutional at this point.
Do you think that the court has been too secretive?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, yes, I do. I mean, I think it's outrageous. I mean,
shouldn't we have transparency when we're talking about things that change our lives?
We should. You know, Justice Stevens has a funny line he uses. He says, look, what do you mean we're secretive? We're the only branch of government that explains our reasons for absolutely everything we do. And, you know, yes, that's true to a certain extent. I think it's preposterous and absurd that Supreme Court arguments are not televised. What is the possible harm in that? But Justice Souter has said there will be cameras in the courtroom over his dead body. So that gives you some idea of what the chances are.
He doesn't believe in television. Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Lenny.